तस्मै श्री गुरुदेव नमः। श्री चैतन्य नमोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपा कदा मायं ददाति स्वापदान्तिकम्। वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरु श्रीयुतपदकमलं श्रीगुरुवैष्णवचंश श्रीरूपं साग्रजासहगण रघुनाथतं वितं तं सजीवं सद्वैतं सर्वभूतं परिजनासहितं कृष्णचैतन्यं देवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपदा सहगणललिता श्रीविशाखावितं च। नमो विष्णुपदाय कृष्णपृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमतिभक्तिचैतन्यस्वामीति नामिने। नमो विष्णुपदाय कृष्णपृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमतिभक्तिवेदान्तस्वामीति नामिने। नमस्ते सरस्वतीदेवे गौरवाणे प्रचारिणे निर्विशेषशून्यवादी पश्चादेशाचारिणे श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वै जगदधर श्रीनिवासरि गौरभक्तवृन्द। हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे, हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे, हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Hare Krishna, welcome to the Vedic Version Show, 92.2 East Wave Radio. I'm Jagannath Charan Das, and we'll be taking this transcendental journey together to the hour of 6 o'clock this morning. And this morning, we have a very, very special guest in the studios, and it's none other than Her Grace Urmila Devi Dasi. And she's flown over from overseas, rather from America, right here to grace us South Africa, and to give her a hearty warm welcome. We say Hare Krishna to you. Hare Krishna Mataji.
Hare Krishna.
And thank you for coming to our country, and thank you for taking this time out so early in the morning to come out here in our studios and, you know, giving us your grace and your presence here. So just after this little transcendental musical break, we're going to tell you about Mataji. We're going to give you her profile, and then we're going to go right into the program. So lock those dials on 92.2 East Wave Radio. And if you do have any questions for us, you can give us a call on 011-854-4412. And if you have any questions, please give us a call on that particular number. So let's take another transcendental musical break, and then we get back into our program.
Thank you.
So Hare Krishna, if you just joined us, you tuned to the Vedic Version Show 92.2 East Wave Radio. And in the studios this morning, we have a very, very special guest, and it's Her Grace Urmila Devi Dasi, all the way from America. So we're going to tell you about Mataji this morning. Her Grace Urmila Devi Dasi was born in 1955 in New York City. Mataji joined ISKCON in 1973 in Chicago, and she has been state and district champion in speaking, going to the quarterfinals in the national tournament. She also won many awards in debates tournament. She received her first initiation in 1973 and a second initiation in 1975 from His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. She had several opportunities along with her family to meet with him personally. And in 1973, she married Prayatsa Prabhu, and she had three children. Murari Das, a disciple of Satsarup Maharaj, married and working as a software engineer. Champa Kalata Devi Dasi, a disciple of Bir Krishna Maharaj, married and working as a Bharatnatyam dancer. And Keshava Das, married and CEO of Divine Foods and Prasadam business. They also have 10 grandchildren. Wonderful, Mataji.
Actually, now we have 11.
And Prabhu and Mataji have lived in Vanaprastha since early 1996. She lives under the protection of her son, and she is a Bachelor of Science from, she has a Bachelor of Science degree from Excelsior College of the University of the State of New York in Religion and Education. Wow, Mataji. Master of School Administration, MSA, and Doctorate of Education in Education Leadership from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She has mainly served ISKCON since 1973 till the present time as book distributor, assistant secretary for the BBT, pujari, temple cook, actress, writer, traveling preacher, editor of BTG since 1990, primary and secondary teacher for 27 years, school principal for 18 years, member of the Shastric Advisory Council to the GBC. Her publication includes Vaikun Children, a guidebook for education in ISKCON, Dr. Best Learn to Read, and 83 books complete literacy program with technology enabling the storybooks to speak in 25 languages at the touch of a special pen. So Mataji is going to tell us all about that this morning. So, Hare Krishna, Mataji.
Hare Krishna.
And thank you for coming. But before we get into that, one very, very important question. Can you please share with the listeners out there about how you first came into contact with ISKCON and Srila Prabhupada?
Well, it's interesting because the music you were playing a little while ago is how I came into contact with ISKCON and Srila Prabhupada.
Hare Krishna.
You were playing the Happening album, Srila Prabhupada chanting Hare Krishna. And in 1967, when I used to visit my older married sister on the Lower East Side in New York, there was a shop called The Krishna Store that was run by Alan Coleman, who had produced that record album. So I used to walk around the neighborhood when I was visiting my sister, and I'd walk into his shop called The Krishna Shop, and I would listen to that recording of Srila Prabhupada chanting. So Mr. Coleman also had posters, like Brijbasi posters from India of Krishna, and I would look at the pictures of Krishna and listen to Srila Prabhupada chanting. So that was my first contact with the Hare Krishna movement.
Sure. Wow. And how did you pursue coming into Krishna consciousness, Mataji?
Well, that's actually a very long story, but a couple years later, in 69, I got a copy of the album that George Harrison produced, the Radha Krishna Temple album, which has on it Yamuna Devi Dasi singing the Brahma Samhita that's played every morning at ISKCON temples. So I heard that on the radio. And inside the record album that I bought, there was a picture of Radha and Krishna. And one day at school, one of the other students at school was reading Krishna book that had the same picture on it. And I said, oh, I have that picture on my wall. So this other student said, oh, would you like to read the book? I said, sure. And then he said, would you like to come to the temple? What temple? There's a temple? What temple? So that was how I first had my contact with the movement. And then later on, in 72. I found Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita in the room of a friend of a friend of a friend at college, and I read it and said, this is what I want to do with my life. Then I was, at that time, I was doing some volunteer work in Chicago as part of my bachelor's degree. And there I met the devotees, and I stayed at the temple for a couple weeks. Actually, as soon as I stayed there for one night, I said, this is what I want to do. And then I moved into the ashram, and there I've been.
Never looking back.
Maybe looking back a couple times, but never going back.
Mataji, another important question that you can really, your fondest memory with His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. I know you have many, but that one that particularly comes to mind.
I don't have one that particularly, I have several. But I could tell you one that I really like.
Or maybe two, too.
Maybe two, okay. So in 1975, Srila Prabhupada was visiting New York just for a few days. When he was leaving to go to London, a few of us accompanied him to the airport. So in order to understand this story, you have to realize that in those days in the airports, there was no security at all. You could go onto the airplane if you didn't have a ticket and get somebody settled, and you know, you could get your grandma settled in her seat, and then you could walk off the plane. There was no security, zero. And the other thing you have to remember about those days is that anybody could smoke cigarettes anywhere. There was no restriction on smoking. So you have to. Those two things are important to know for this story to make sense. Srila Prabhupada left in a car, and the rest of us left in various cars. My husband was at work, it was during the day, so I went with my very young son, who was just an infant. And our cars left after Srila Prabhupada, but somehow we got to the airport before him, and the devotees had a big bag of flower petals. So somehow or other, we entered the airport at the back door by the airline offices. We didn't go in the front door. Again, remember, there was no question of security. The doors weren't locked. It was a very different world. So the devotees took the flower petals and they were throwing them on the floor in front of Srila Prabhupada, making a path of flower petals from the door to the airport to the lounge. Srila Prabhupada was a frequent flyer, and so he was able to go to the frequent flyer lounge. So we had a whole carpet of flower petals. And the lounge at that point in the New York airport was under construction, so somehow we were the only people in the lounge. And Srila Prabhupada sat on a couch, on a sofa. There weren't more than, 20 devotees max, I'm thinking it was like 15, that went to the airport. So I sat to Srila Prabhupada's left, right next to the couch. So I was less than a meter from Srila Prabhupada. I was facing him, and he was looking straight ahead, and I was on his left, and I had my baby in my lap. So he sat down, and everybody sat down around him. Srila Prabhupada was talking to the devotees there, many of whom he had known since he started the movement. Sai Kirtananda was there, and Satyabhama. Satyabhama and her 3-year-old son had stayed for a couple days at our house. They were visiting from another place, and she had woken up early that morning to make sandesh for Srila Prabhupada. She had prepared. And her 3-year-old son had been saying ever since he woke up in the morning, I want to go with Prabhupada to London. I want to go with Prabhupada to London. So Srila Prabhupada knew a lot of these devotees very intimately, and he was asking them, you know, he asked Shalavati, how are your sons doing? And he asked Kirtananda, where's Hayagriva? How is he doing? And I was feeling that it was very sweet that Srila Prabhupada had that kind of relationship with some of the devotees. You know, I didn't know Prabhupada on that level of intimacy. But it was very casual. It was, in one sense, it was the sort of small talk you would have with friends. But in another sense, it was Srila Prabhupada showing that he was very interested in the personal lives of the devotees. How is this person doing? How is this going on with your life? You know, sometimes people may think that in spiritual life, we don't care about things like that. You know, we don't have normal human compassion and normal human relationship. So that wasn't the case at all with Srila Prabhupada. So then the devotees brought out a huge tray. It must have been one of the deity's silver trays. I mean, huge. I can't show you on the radio, but it was very big. And it was piled high with fruit, cut pieces of fruit, all different varieties into a sort of pyramid shape. It must have been set up at the airport. You couldn't possibly have transported it like that. In trying to describe how big it was, I mean, the tray was at least a foot wide and 2 feet long.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a huge, heavy silver tray, piled high, probably about half a meter high, as a pyramid with cut fruit. So they brought that in front of Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada took the watermelon from the top of the pyramid and kind of leaned his head back and popped it into his mouth. And then he had this, again, it's hard to do it just in sound, but Prabhupada took his right hand and sort of flicked his wrist in this very elegant way, and again with his head back, he just said, "Distribute." So the devotee took around the tray, and of course everybody only wanted to eat the watermelon, which Srila Prabhupada had eaten. Nobody was interested in the rest of the fruit. And then they brought out another tray, just as big, piled just as high, with milk sweets, burfi and sandesh and para. And I remember thinking, wow, people must have been working for a week to make all of those sweets. And it was an incredible number of milk sweets. And Srila Prabhupada didn't take any. He just looked at it and then again just put his head back and sort of flicked his hand and said, "Distribute." But nobody wanted any because Prabhupada hadn't taken any. Nobody was interested. So in the meantime, there was a conversation going on between our GBC, who was Rupanuga, and some airport official in the back of the room. It was obviously a heated discussion. And Prabhupada was very jovial. He was very relaxed. He asked, you know, "What is this?" So Jayadwaita Swami, who was Brahmachari at the time, I'm pretty sure it was him, who said, "Oh, Prabhupada, they're complaining about the flower petals. They want us to clean up all the flower petals." So at that time, being very young, we weren't so concerned about what the world thought of us. And we didn't have like a public relations communication department concerned with public. Now we have that in ISKCON, you know. But at that time, we didn't care so much about public opinion, if they were complained about the flower petals or not. And then one of the devotees said, again, I think it was Jayadwaita, but I'm not sure, said, "Prabhupada, there's cigarette butts all over the airport," which was true, because people were smoking everywhere. And when they finished their cigarette, they just threw it on the floor. They didn't put it in a particular receptacle, and the floor was covered with cigarette butts. And there was somebody going around with a big dust mop, you know, cleaning it all up all the time. I said, "Prabhupada, nobody tells the people to clean up their cigarettes. They complain about cigarettes, but they don't complain about cigarettes, but they complain about flowers. They complain about roses, you know? If you get roses on the floor, that you have to clean up." So Prabhupada laughed. And he told us a story about how his godbrothers went to Burma. And in Burma, the local people had a custom that they would take a dead dog and they would put it in a container and bury it underground until the body had turned to liquid. And then they would take this liquid dog and drink it as a special treat. He said, but when his godbrothers went there and they were cooking with ghee, when you cook with ghee, there's the fragrance of butter. You know, it's very wonderful fragrance. So they would complain, "Oh, what is this terrible smell?" So Prabhupada that told us this story. Yeah. And then the devotee said, "Prabhupada, can we have kirtan?" And Prabhupada said, "Oh, that will be worse than the flowers." You know? I said, no. Then Prabhupada said, "Well, then we will have very quiet kirtan." So one devotee, Jai Satchinandana, he was leading the kirtan, he was playing murdanga. Prabhupada was playing kartals. And first he was singing, I remember he sang first Guru Vastika or Guru Vandana, but he sang both, Guru Vastika and Guru Vandana. And Srila Prabhupada had his own pair of kartals that he was playing very quietly on the edge. You know, so the sound was very, very quiet. And as Srila Prabhupada was playing the kartals, His head was down, his eyes were closed, he was in a deep meditation. And again, I was sitting, it was less than a meter from Srila Prabhupada, and I was very moved at the fact that although we were chanting these prayers to him, he was chanting them to his spiritual master. In one sense, that may sound like a very obvious thing, but for me it was a very deep thing. That Srila Prabhupada was as absorbed, or probably a lot more absorbed, in meditation on his spiritual master as we were absorbed in him. That, people sometimes may think that someone who takes the role of spiritual master is in the mood of being a master, but that's not a fact. Someone who's taking the role of spiritual master is in the mood of servant to their spiritual master. They're in the mood of servant to Krishna. And taking the position of spiritual master is an incredibly deep sacrifice, where you're giving of yourself and your energy to help others who are less fortunate. Just like we laud people who give up a comfortable life to go to some poverty-stricken or war-torn area of the world and help people who are less fortunate than themselves, in which case they often have to live in the same condition as the people that they're helping. So it's a fact that such people may get some glorification from the world for doing that, and probably some people do it for the purpose of getting such glorification. But still, to sacrifice yourself for the sake of others is a very different kind of satisfaction. And that was what I was feeling very much from Srila Prabhupada at that time, that he was sacrificing himself for us. And we were not, how do we put this? Traditionally, a spiritual master would accept only disciples who are very highly qualified. Traditionally, you accept only a disciple who comes from a very qualified family, who's been given the samskaras from conception, and who already has a purified mind. Just like modern universities, generally, they have admissions requirements. You can't just walk in the door and say, I want to be a student, and that's enough. You have to have already studied. You have to be receptive, because the university is thinking, why should we waste our resources and our energy on somebody unless they already have a certain level of qualification? And one of the things I do, I'm a professor of sociology at our college in Belgium. And if you get a student who hasn't been properly trained in secondary school, it's very difficult to teach them, because you have to go back and teach them what they should have learned before they came to you. So that was the traditional, practically you could say almost a rule, almost a Shastric rule, that the guru is only supposed to accept very qualified disciples. In fact, the rule is that both the guru and disciple have to test each other for at least a year before initiation. And again, it's expected that the disciple is going to come in with a lot of spiritual qualification from their own family. But Srila Prabhupada didn't do that. He tested us, certainly. He had a rule that you had to be chanting and following no illicit sex, no intoxication, no meat eating, no gambling for at least 6 months before he would give what he called first initiation, Harinam, and then another 6 months before he would complete the initiation process with the full Diksha of Gayatri Mantra. So totally a year also of testing. But Srila Prabhupada didn't require that we had any kind of previous qualification. That's also, you could say, in line with transcendent Shastra, although the ordinary materialistic Dharma Shastras would say you have to take people only from high-class families. So Rupa Goswami, in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, he says the only thing you need to start bhakti yoga is a desire, is some taste, some inclination. And whether or not you followed Varnashram or whether or not you're a pious person is irrelevant. And Srila Prabhupada really took that. And he went to people, most of us, from a Vedic perspective, didn't have a pious background in this life. You know, maybe some of us did in previous lives, but that wasn't apparent. And although certainly many of us had pious backgrounds in this life from a Western perspective, that our families may have been good Christians or good Jews or something like that, from a Vedic perspective, our families weren't very pious at all. You know, so you're a good Christian or a good Jew, but you're eating cow meat from the time you're 6 months old. You know, that's not very Vedically pious. You know, you're drinking wine from the time you're two or something like that. So, and most of us had very impersonal understandings of God. Most of us came from, again, from a Vedic perspective, very low families. And from a bhakti perspective, we were very unqualified. Most of us thought of God as just some sort of white light. But Srila Prabhupada took us because we had some interest. That was enough, that we had an interest, that we had some taste, that we had some attraction. For whatever reason, whether, as Rupa Goswami says, from a past life, or because Prabhupada sparked that in us with no previous lifetimes of qualification. Who knows? I'm sure for each of us the story is very different. And there was Srila Prabhupada in the middle of the New York airport, you know, far from the Dham, in this mood of connecting us through his guru all the way to God. And his mood was that of a servant. You know, Prabhupada was asked another time that I saw Srila Prabhupada in an airport when he was arriving, and Prabhupada was speaking about different classes of people. He talked about fourth class, third class, second class, first class. You know, the first class person is somebody who's clean and tolerant, righteous, etc. And the reporter said, oh, so you must also be a first class man. Prabhupada said, no, I'm a fifth class man because I am the servant of the fourth class man. And that was Srila Prabhupada's mood. And Prabhupada's mood was not, I am the spiritual master. Srila Prabhupada's mood was, I am the servant. He saw us as his disciples, as helping him serve his guru, facilitating him serve his guru. And that he really saw us as co-devotees. You know, there are many, many stories when Prabhupada would be with devotees and someone would say, okay, all the devotees have to leave the room now, and Prabhupada would also get up and leave. And they'd say, no, not usually, Prabhupada. Or the devotees have to go, and Prabhupada would go with. So that was his mood. His mood wasn't, I'm superior to you and you're serving me. And I really felt that. I mean, I've given a long explanation of it, but I felt that in a few seconds. It was one of those things where in just a moment you have sort of an ocean of understanding. And then I don't know if everybody in the room had the same experience. I've actually never asked them, although I've talked to a number of other people who were there at the time. But the experience that I had, and at the time I felt that everyone else in the room was having the same experience, was that all time and space basically disappeared. That the kirtan was all-encompassing, that it was all there was, and that we weren't in the airport, we weren't in New York, it wasn't whatever time it was, 10 in the morning or something like that. I didn't have any sense of how long we were chanting. It seemed to me that we were chanting for hours and hours and hours. I mean, realistically, we couldn't have been chanting for more than 20 minutes. But the experience of the kirtan was something beyond the world. It was something beyond time and space. And although I was certainly very, not that I'm any different now, but although I was certainly a baby in spiritual life, I'm still a baby in spiritual life, but anyway, I had a sense of being in the spiritual world. I had a sense that I was in a transcendent realm. It's very difficult to describe the experience in words. I don't really know how I can do justice to it in words. Again, I felt that everybody was in that same experience. You know, in retrospect, I just don't know. So then at a certain point, I got some awareness again that I was in the room and that my baby was on my lap. You know, I sort of came to a different consciousness again. And I thought, oh, Prabhupada's probably about to go to the airport, to the airplane. You know, we're not going to be able to stay in the lounge. And I haven't attended to my child for a while. And if I don't change his nappy, his diaper, you know, his clothes are going to get all wet. And I better take care of him. I'm not going to get another chance. You know, we're going to go to the gate and then we're going to have to go to the car and we're going to go back. And I don't want to inconvenience anybody. So I started taking care of him in my lap, taking the stuff out of my bag and changing him. And as I did that, my attention went to what I was doing and my chanting became superficial. So I switched from like this deep absorption in the kirtan to an absorption in what I was doing. And I was still chanting with my mouth, but I wasn't really there anymore. And as I was doing that, again, if you remember, that Srila Prabhupada was just sitting a very short distance away from me. I was sitting right next to the edge of the couch. And as I described previously, Prabhupada's head was down, his eyes were closed, and he was playing cartels. And he himself was obviously completely absorbed in this chanting. So as I'm busy with my baby, Srila Prabhupada very, very slowly lifted his head up and then very, very slowly, almost as if it was watching something in slow motion, turned his head to the side to face me, turned his head to the left, and then again very, very slowly opened his eyes. And then while he was continuing to chant, he looked at me for a very long time. And I was sort of frozen. I sort of stopped what I was doing. And I was just looking back at Srila Prabhupada. The feeling I had at the time is that I had caused a disturbance. Not so much because I was taking care of my child, but because I had lost my focus. That in the process of taking care of my child, I had lost my focus. That I was expected to continue to focus no matter what I was doing. And that my loss of focus had... that Prabhupada had noticed, that he was aware. That was how I felt at the time. Again, in retrospect, I have to say that I have no idea what he was thinking because he didn't say anything. So I don't know if he was pleased or displeased or what he was noticing or what he was thinking. But that was my impression at the time. Later, much later on, when Prabhupada translated Chaitanya Charitamrita, and we read some of these stories about how at Mahaprabhu would have these kirtans at the house of Srivas Thakur. I mean, he also had kirtans that were on the public street for everybody. But he had nightly kirtans at the house of Srivas Thakur that were very private. They were only for very intimate and realized persons. And there were several different occasions when other people snuck in to the kirtans. I mean, one I was just reading about recently was when this one brahmana who had was only drinking milk, that was his austerity, he didn't eat solid food. Mm. And he had, with Srivas Thakur's permission, snuck into the kirtan to observe. And Lord Chaitanya said, "Why aren't I feeling any ecstasy? You know, who is this person in the kirtan?" And Srivas said, "Well, I've led him into the kirtan. He wanted to see." And Mahaprabhu said, "You know, does he think that he can please me just by drinking milk? What is this? You know, throw him out." And as the Brahmin was leaving, he felt very repentant. he felt, oh, I had been proud of my austerities, and I thought that by my austerities I could conquer God. And he felt sorry that he had caused a disturbance. And when Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu understood that he felt repentant, then he actually did give him mercy and did reveal himself to that brahmana. Anyway, I hadn't read that story yet. It hadn't been published yet. But that was how I felt. I felt as if my own lack of absorption had disturbed Srila Prabhupada. That he had noticed it and that it had disturbed his own absorption. Anyway, he looked at me for a very long time. Of course, I had to finish what I was doing, and then Prabhupada put his cartels away and stood up and started moving toward the gate. We followed him, having a kirtan. Again, you could not do this in the modern airports, but we went with our mridanga and cartels and everything, and we followed Srila Prabhupada directly to the gate. There Srila Prabhupada was standing in the queue to get on the airplane, and the three-year-old boy whose mother and he had stayed the night at our house, a couple nights at our house, he ran and got in the queue with Srila Prabhupada. And the airline employee was trying to remove him. And Prabhupada said, no, he is passenger. His mother told me later she was thinking, you know, he doesn't have a passport, he doesn't have a ticket. Prabhupada's going to London, how is this going to work? So she took him out of the queue. But years later, she said to me, maybe I should have let him go. Maybe somehow it would have worked out all right if he had gone. So that's one of my favorite memories of being with Srila Prabhupada.
Srimataji, that was absolutely wonderful. And I hope this radio station can give us more time so that we can discuss more about Srila Prabhupada. Because from this new generation, we haven't had any personal contact with Srila Prabhupada. So hearing these stories and imbibing in our heart, we really getting goosebumps and we really feel tearful this morning, Mataji. So again, once again, we're going to welcome Prasthit Mataji. Prasthit Mataji, Hare Krishna to you, and thank you for coming.
Hare Krishna Prabhu, it's great to be here. So we are so blessed today to have the presence of such a great devotee with such great experiences. I think we're going to take a short musical break, and when we come back, we're going to launch into some discussions with Mataji around children. I know she's doing a seminar this weekend, and so we'd like to invite people to also attend there.
And absolutely, and we're going to discuss some of our Mamandaji's books as well and where they are available. So she's going to tell us in a jiffy. So let's take another transcendental musical break, and it's none other than Srila Prabhu.
Sorry, Mataji, you've only got one.
Why did you take this one? You take this one? Just for a minute, right? And then okay. You get back in. So give Mataji enough change. We still got time. Hare Krishna.
That's an old picture.
Very beautiful. You haven't changed much.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely. I'll pass this message on to her.
That picture was taken in my 30s.
And listen to you.
Maybe we'll have another program in the evening.
Uh-huh.
Where Mataji can tell us more.
Is that Iskand Desire Tree?
Yeah,
of course.
Brilliant. Hare Krishna. That was one of the listeners, Mataji, and she says she's really inspired. And she's motivated at how you had this personal contact with Srila Prabhupada, and she'd like to hear more.
So, well, if I told all my stories about Srila Prabhupada, I'd be on
your phone. I think we'll make a lot of devotees.
I'd be on the radio for a long time. I'd overstep your time limit.
Mataji, I think we need that. So it's really wonderful.
Well, I'm not sure if I want to come at 5 in the morning again, though.
That's the whole problem.
Yes.
I think people don't want to come so early. That's why they give us that slot. But it's an auspicious hour.
Nobody else wants to come that morning, so they give us that. I didn't want to come that early either. I thought it was going to be 6 o'clock. I was prepared for 6 o'clock.
It was from 5 to 7, but they took the whole program.
And then this morning they said, no, you have to be there at 5.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you.
So, okay, so what you wanted? What was the question? Okay, so balancing the two. Okay, all right, okay. Hare Krishna. Oh, that was another guest, Matiji, another listener. She wanted to know, how do you balance your tertiary education with Krishna consciousness? You asked it.
And what was the other one? More stories.
We just have like 7 minutes, though, right?
No. We'll steal some time, Matiji. For Krishna, we should do everything.
Generally, for Krishna, we should be mortal. But I thought you said we have just till 5:50.
10 to 6, but we will go till 6 o'clock.
Well, what generally happens at 10 to 6?
The next presenter comes in.
Well, if they're waiting, we have to let them come in.
Not for Prabhupada.
We normally do Nishinga prayers and stuff up until 6. So we'll cut the Nishinga prayers. We'd rather let the listeners have the mercy.
I think people need Krishna's mercy and especially this time of the morning. You want to go for it, Madam?
So, Hare Krishna and welcome back. We've had very good responses from listeners out there, so thank you so much for listening attentively and for posing some of your questions. So, I'll just be the conduit to posing those questions. The last listener that called through asked a very pertinent question with relation to tertiary education. So how do you actually balance that sort of requirement with the need to have spirituality in your life? And Matiji is extremely qualified to answer this question. She is a professor and has been initiated for many, many years. So Matiji?
I'm not quite sure what they mean by how do you balance tertiary education with Krishna consciousness. Do they mean how do you balance getting your degree with being Krishna conscious?
Yes.
If you really want to know the answer to that, I would refer you to our Back to Godhead magazine, 2012, November-December issue. I have an article in there that discusses how I balance my Krishna consciousness with getting my degree. That article is primarily a journal that I wrote while I was doing the internship that was required for my PhD, where I had to work in a government school. So I would refer you to that rather than going through it in detail here.
So it's the BTG, which one? Which issue is it?
November-December 2012.
So in November-December 2012, Back to Godhead, right?
Yes, I have an article there on that very topic. I mean, I also do, I'm not going to be doing it here, but I also have a presentation which you can listen to on ISKCON Desire Tree called Material and Spiritual Balance. So I'd refer you to that, to go to ISKCON Desire Tree on the internet and go to audio, Mataji's. It'll probably be under seminars. Mm-hmm. And there's recordings there of Material Spiritual Balance. I just gave that seminar in Durban. Although, I'm not really scheduled to do that here.
Okay. And this weekend, Mataji, we see that you're giving a seminar on children, rearing Krishna conscious children in this sort of day and age. So can you just tell us a little bit about that and what some of the things are to take away from there?
Well, you'll have to come to the seminar.
I intend to.
You want me to give the whole seminar now in 2 minutes on the radio, huh? So it's going to be focused on four keys to really having your children imbibe Krishna conscious culture. And although the focus is on parenting and children, most people who've attended this seminar feel that the points and the topic is really relevant in general, how to help people take up spiritual life and be convinced and enthused in spiritual life.
So if you're not doing anything this weekend on Saturday, we invite you to...
Only if you're not doing anything, right?
Please do come anyway. Even if you have something that's important, because this is far more important.
Far more important.
So do come. It's on Saturday at the Hare Krishna Temple, and it's starting at 3 o'clock. Do call us for some details, and we'll tell you who to contact to make sure that your seat has been booked, because I think it's going to be wildly popular. today's day and age, when we've got all these things going wrong with our kids, you know, drugs and smoking and drinking, it's very important for us to understand how can we sort of get their minds back into a spiritual mode. Because if you teach them with a value-based system, then it's far easier for them to grow into solid adults.
Well, I'll disagree with you there.
Ah, okay.
Because that's the cure of the materialists. They say, teach the kids values. Does it work?
Not always.
Not generally.
Mm-hmm.
All over the world. All over the world. Everyone's trying to teach the kids values. Please don't think there's any school system anywhere in the world that is saying, we don't care about teaching the kids values. I think that would be highly unlikely, almost impossible, to think that there's even one school anywhere in the world that says, we don't care about teaching the kids values. And my guess would be that every school in the world makes some determined, concerted, deliberate, explicit effort to teach the kids values. Now, you may have some families that don't care about it, but even that's unusual. You know, you're really only going to find your most suffering or criminal families that don't think about teaching their kids values. So that's not the answer. Do you know that most values are simply in the mode of passion?
Okay.
The mode of ignorance is, let me enjoy the world in a sinful way. The mode of passion is, let me enjoy the world in a pious way as a good person. The mode of goodness is, let me be a good person for the sake of salvation. And transcendence is, let me be a good person to please the Lord. And frankly, if you're trying to be a good person just to enjoy the world, which is the level at which most values education is taught, almost all, there's hardly anyone that even teaches values for the sake of salvation and enlightenment, which is the mode of goodness. What to speak of for love of God, which is transcendence. So if your purpose is, let me be a good person to enjoy the world, the main function is, let me enjoy the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? If you end up thinking that maybe you can enjoy the world more by being sinful than by being pious, you may go there. Mm-hmm. And that's the danger of the mode of passion. The mode of passion is righteousness.
Right.
Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mode of passion. But the motive for Dharma in the mode of passion is selfishness. The motive for Dharma in the mode of goodness is transcendence. But unless you cure that motive, I mean, think about it in terms of our individual life. Most people
mm-hmm.
in this world, I'm sure most people in South Africa, even though you have such a high crime rate, I'm sure, completely sure, that the vast majority of people in South Africa are not criminals.
Mm.
And if you ask most people, are you basically an honest person? Their answer would be yes. But if you ask most people, are you absolutely an honest person?
Mm-hmm.
Who would say yes? So that means that although the vast majority of people, I don't know what percent, but the vast majority of people think of themselves as basically honest.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just take honesty as one of the values and have an ideal of themselves of being honest and want to be honest. They find they're not always honest.
Mm-hmm.
Why? What is it that causes somebody who believes in truthfulness and honesty and integrity, who wants to be a person of integrity, who strives to be a person of integrity, who believes in it, why do they fail sometimes?
Mm.
And if you analyze, you'll see the failure point is fear.
Mm.
That if my personal self-interest, if my personal safety is threatened enough, then I'll say, oh, I guess in this situation I can't be honest.
Right.
We'll sacrifice our values for self-preservation, whether it's honesty, whether it's kindness, whether it's responsibility, whatever it is, whatever value you teach anybody and you imbibe to them in whatever way you teach them, it really doesn't matter. Unless a person is free from fear, they cannot be absolutely a person of values.
Mm.
It's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And if people are basically materialistic, their fear level is very low. Because a materialistic person thinks, I'm this body, And by low, I mean the line is very low. They have a lot of fear. In other words, the line at which fear kicks in is a very low line. It doesn't take much for such a person to become fearful.
Mm-hmm.
If I am a person of integrity, if I'm a person of kindness and compassion, that I may suffer in some way. And so they'll give up their values. And as long as people are materialistic and think that I am this body and this world is for me to enjoy, they're not going to have values at a very high level. It's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
They may want to in some way. It's not that a person doesn't want to. But what they want more is they want to be happy in this world. And if there's a conflict between being happy and safe in this world and being a person of integrity and being a person of high values and high morality, guess what'll go?
Mm.
The only way that you can keep values at a high level is that you have very little fear.
Right.
That your level at which fear kicks in is very high. So for that, you have to come at least to the mode of goodness.
Mm.
And really to have that absolutely, you have to come to transcendence. So because most countries in the world are now secular, and religious education is forbidden by most of the countries of the world, at least in the government schools. The media is primarily secular.
Mm.
People are being taught, you are simply a bag of chemicals, and this life is simply to get some stimulation for your senses and your mind, and there's nothing more than that. Teaching values alongside that is not going to solve the problem, because people can't maintain it.
That's right.
They can't maintain it. And that's another illusion, that we're going to make the world a nice place by teaching values. How many people in the world aren't concerned with higher values? Tiny, tiny, tiny fraction.
Mm.
Frankly, even most criminals think that they're good people, if you really want to know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
The actually thoroughly evil person is a rare person indeed. So that's not how you're going to solve the problem. We have to understand that we're a spiritual being.
Mm.
There's no question of my safety. You know, in this country, everybody's obsessed with safety. It's quite interesting. You know, there's hardly any countries in the world like that. I haven't seen any other country where everybody has razor wire and anywhere in the world. Nowhere. But the only real safety, na jayate miyate vakadachan, na yam bhutva bhavita bhanabhuya, ajo nitra sasvatoyam parano na hanyate hanyamane shrire. The only real safety is an enlightenment.
Mm.
And you know that I'm a soul. And if I know that I'm a soul, there's no question actually of self-preservation, because I'm never born and I never die. And because I'm eternal and I can't be hurt.
Mm.
And because my happiness is not dependent on my possessions in this world and my relationships in this world and my situations, well, have nothing to do with them, really. Then I can be fully who I am, which as a soul is a person of incredible integrity. I'm part of God in any situation. And unless you bring that to people, you will not change the world. You just won't. It's a dream. It's simply a dream. And therefore people go on and on and on with material solutions. I mean, obviously teaching values is better than teaching criminality. You know, to go from the mode of ignorance to the mode of passion is a step up.
Mm-hmm.
But it won't, that alone, it's not going to be enough.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be enough. And I understand why governments have gone to secularism.
Mm.
But it doesn't have to be either secularism or sectarianism. There's another alternative of universal transcendence. And universal transcendence and love of God does not have to be understood within a particular sectarian faith. But unless human beings come to that platform, our problems will not be solved. You can solve a little bit of them sometimes for a little bit of time. But that's all. You cannot. It's another values education, is another cheating.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's combined with transcendent education and love of God.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Masiji, for that. Thank you for correcting me. I really appreciate it. It's, you know, this.
Well, I wasn't trying to correct you.
But it's good for me to learn these things because, you know, any instruction that we get from such senior disciples who are more enlightened than ourselves are welcome. So thank you very, very much for that. I know that our time is up. So we thank everybody for listening, and we do invite you to come on Saturday to hear such inspiring discussions.
Well, we would invite you also. We produce these, as you mentioned in the beginning, we produce these 83 books for children that really go beyond and encompass ordinary morality to teach transcendence. And they're available on the internet at illuminationeducation.com. And on illuminationeducation.com, we also have a lot of free books for download. So we just put up a new book about Lord Chaitanya, and they're also available from Krishna.com and Bhaktivedanta Library Services.
Okay, so we're going to love and leave you there, and we wish you a wonderfully spiritual Wednesday, and we'll leave you with a short musical break before Sanjay takes over. So Hare Krishna, and I'll hand you over to Prabhu.